You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Deborah Kennedy, and welcome here, Deborah. Nice to talk with you today.
Hi, Brainerd. I'm very excited to be here. Thanks so much for this opportunity.
Let's talk about your book. I know that's just come out, Art and Poetry for the Earth. Can you tell me a little bit about how that book came to be and maybe a little of the background for that book?
Yes, I've worked quite a bit as, you know, really my early career was all as a fine artist. And I was primarily doing large-scale installations with environmental themes. And so I was doing work on ideas like Earthwise. Humans are so smart. We're so clever. You just look at a jet engine or all the technology that's allowing me to talk to you right now. Incredibly clever, but we're not wise. Nature is wise. And so I did a large-scale installation with heads that were sort of like, they look partly like stones and partly like human heads, and with the idea we need to take nature as our mentor. And I did work on systems thinking, the new type of thinking that we need to embrace to really solve our environmental problems, and the extinction crisis. So a lot of environmental themes. And at a certain point, I had my first solo museum show, very exciting. But afterwards, I started to realize I wanted to speak more directly about these issues, like I'm able to right here with you.
And so speaking more directly, meaning as opposed to using visual art, writing a book.
Yes. So the book can go out into the world, and it's also kind of a platform for being able to discuss these ideas. And in fine art, there you are, you know, I was always a conceptually based artist. So I always had a huge amount of wall text, and I'd be explaining to people, all right, this is about hormone disruption. And I would, you know, be telling them all about it. And but I realized, yeah, it's a pretty indirect way to try and communicate on these issues. And so I decided to pick a much more direct way, poetry and illustration. But my book has 32 poems about different environmental issues. It's called Nature Speaks, Art and Poetry for the Earth. And so I have the poem and then very detailed ink illustrations that respond to each poem. So some of them are surreal, some of them are highly representational, some more lyrical. And then I also included a short essay. And I talked to a young man the other day, and he said he really enjoyed that. He really got how it was three different ways to look at an idea, and that he really felt like he had learned a lot about the science and ecology that's contained in the book as well.
So that's exciting. I mean, this is really kind of a mission you're on. I mean, it's really interesting to talk about the relationship between art and this book, and seeing this book as being, in terms of, maybe a mission is the wrong word, but even in terms of activism or raising consciousness, you felt that the book format and writing is more effective than the visual art.
I think for me at this time, it really... That's my hope and that's my goal, and it's been working out pretty well. The book has gotten a number of awards. It's been so exciting to have it recognized in that way. So I won in poetry for a Nautilus Book Award. So that's a national book award. Their tagline is Better Books for a Better World, and they focus on this sort of, as you're saying, a mission or activism, all their books. And then the other one is the Eric Hoffer Book Award. He was a moral philosopher, an American moral philosopher, and also a National Book Award. And this book award focuses on free-thinking authors. And so I really liked that as sort of the direction of that award.
I like that, too. I think everyone wants the award for a free thinker, you know, or an artist. Anyway, that's wonderful. So I want to talk more about the book, but perhaps you could we could read an excerpt from the book and talk about that, or a few excerpts. Do you want to begin with one?
Yes. I think what I'll do is I'll give you a little background. So the background is kind of what I have in the essays. And this first one is called Coevolution. And this is like a fundamental concept in the book. And really Darwin was who came up with this concept because he saw an extraordinary orchid, and it's called the Star of Bethlehem. And it had been brought to England. So, you know, in this period, they were out just decimating jungles. They were so obsessed with orchids, bringing them back to England. And he saw this extraordinary orchid. It's got the flowers almost 8 inches wide, this waxy white flower. But below are these long, thin whips hanging down. They're hollow green tubes. And at the very bottom is some nectar. He realized there had to be a pollinator with a proboscis or nose a foot long to reach the nectar. Well, you know, other people of the day, really for 40 years, people laughed at him. Who could imagine a moth flying around with a foot long proboscis? And so now I'll tell you what happened 40 years later. Okay, so I'm just going to read the second half of the poem. The first half kind of gives you that setup. And so laughter rippled through 40 years until the night, an entomologist with animal eyes silently waiting high in the trembling jungle captured the shadow of the hawk moth. Its shaggy wings, 8 inches wide, beat through layered leaves, following the scent of musk. The hawk moth hovered before the radiant star, its slender snout coiled tight, unfurled its length, probed down the orchid spur, sipped the nectar, and bore away a fine coat of pollen. Darwin's vision, a spark through golden amber, orchid and moth in eager embrace, two bound as one across eon's arc.
Lovely and really kind of extraordinary. I didn't know that story, and that's also that's quite amazing. That does seem improbable or impossible, a moth like that. It's so fantastic.
Yes, that it would be a prehensile appendage. It can actually manipulate this proboscis, you know, like a very long, I don't know, maybe a finger, right? And really, coevolution is telling us that these two species evolved together for millions of years, literally pushing each other to greater and greater lengths. And the thing that I want readers to recognize is we have co-evolved. You know, really, coevolution is two species that have this extremely intimate evolutionary relationship. But we've evolved in relationship to water and air and soil and food that no longer exist. We've changed the composition of all the things that support our lives. And we're already bearing the burden of some of those changes. And, you know, I think it's a real question whether we can evolve rapidly enough to keep up with the kind of changes that we're propelling here.
So I want to talk more about that, but perhaps we should read another excerpt. I love hearing hearing you read. Would you like to talk about
sure.
another one?
Sure. These two are both from the first section of the book. So the book has sort of four chapters, and this section is called Living Inside the Circle, Every Part Wedded to the Whole. And this second poem is called Web of Life. And it's dedicated to Dr. W.D. Billing. And I found his work. He was a botanist, and he was one of the first botanists to try and create a vision of how an ecosystem, how it all works together to support life. So he developed this beautiful illustration that I use in the book, and I kind of repeat in my illustrations in the book. All the illustrations are done in earth-toned inks. So, you know, it's art and poetry for the earth. And, you know, like burnt sienna was originally made out of soil. And sepia was originally made out of cuttlefish ink. So these colors obviously resonate for a book about the earth. And so I drew a lot of variations on his illustration, which is called the holoconautic theory of environmental complexity, or a little more friendly, the yarn ball theory of environmental complexity. And it kind of looks like a yarn ball. It's a circle, and there are positions all around the outside of the circle that are all the forces and substances that act and interact to create a living environment for, in the center, a plant. But you could put yourself there as well. So there are those basic things that we remember going back to the four elements of the Greeks, air, fire, water, earth. And then he breaks it down a little bit more finely to like 15 different elements, other plants, other animals, solar radiation, cosmic radiation. He kind of breaks down air into different categories. And it becomes this beautiful image of the web of life for me. And it tells us so much about how we need to live in the world. We tend to still have this sort of pioneering vision of the individual kind of pushing out into the world. But this image tells us how closely knit we are into the web of life and how dependent we are on that and how complex it is. Also, how interdependent all these different elements are. So, for instance, the coevolution idea, if the hawk moth disappears, there's nothing to pollinate for the Star of Bethlehem orchid. So all these little parts are all interdependent, and we're interdependent. We're not at the top. You know, we used to have this chain of being, right? And human being, there was like God and angels, and then humans, and then animals went down the list like this. No, we're just one point on the edge of this circle. We are equal in importance in the web of life. So here's the web of life. It's dedicated to Dr. W.D. Billings. And really, I'm talking about all those different points on this circle that depicts the web of life. Bind together the blooming air, water dancing from pole to frozen pole. The sun's touch brings light to steamy life. The loamy earth, the patient plants, and all the animals, secret family, wed by blood. The sacred fire lights the dark and leaves pure ash. Spin each thread, strong and supple, every strand lit with honey's glow. Weave the cloth an endless circle. Here and there, you and me, all the ones who came before, ancient kin to every pilgrim who walks the path. Life long and loud, sings and whistles, croaks and howls. In our metal days, machine and man clash and grind. This once fine cloth, used so hard, gaping holes torn side to side. Edges fray like fine down feathers. Our broken fingernails black with grease, knuckles grazed with scars. Bind each living fiber, mend the tears, renew the web, until the deserts hum with life and leaf again.
Very beautiful, and I know these are excerpts from the poems, right? Right, they're actually much longer than.
Well, that one I actually was short enough. I got rolling and I read the whole thing. So that is the whole thing. And you know, there's sort of that call at the end to renew life. And you know, I'm really looking for you know, to kind of arouse people so that we care more and, you know, are more willing to put, we're in dire times here. I think that on so many fronts, we're just sort of at the beginning of some very serious impacts from climate change and pollution. Pollution is already impacting us in very difficult ways. So, you know, more respect, more caring, more action.
And you know, you write so beautifully, and this book is done so well. You know, you talk about the transition from visual artist to being a poet as something that seems fairly easy. But of course, poetry is its own craft and approach. How did you approach poetry, and how did you learn to write the way you're writing?
Well, you know, honestly, my husband just was laughing at me. He was going like, "You can't do this," you know. But I took 10 years to do the book. So many of the illustrations take like 40 and 50 hours. They're only 8.5 by 11. So I also took from my art sort of the practice. So I've done, say, stone carving. And with stone carving, first you use the pick and then the chisel and then the large rifflers and then the smaller rifflers and then files. And then after you've gotten the shape all set, then you have 6 layers of sandpaper. So I've gone over these poems sometimes, I mean, just innumerable times. I just kept honing and honing and honing as best I could. I have not, you know, I've mainly just worked on the book. I haven't tried to get out in journals and this sort of thing, but I did apply for one poetry contest and I got 2 awards. So they saw that the writing was polished. And that's sort of my next goal, is to engage with the larger poetry community more. You know, it's, I guess it's obsessive effort, which, you know, you kind of learn that as an artist, right?
But these obsessive efforts still, it's, I mean, I know you spent a long time writing, but you're saying there was a long time in kind of honing and going over these poems, and that's how they evolved? That's how your writing evolved? And if so, was that... under the guide of a teacher, or was it all self-taught in the sense of your editing and your approach to the poems?
When I was writing, I periodically felt like, you know, I should go take a class. I should, get someone as a mentor. And the other part of me was the independent part, which is as an artist is often a very strong part. You know, I didn't really want to be absorbing other people's voices. And, you know, I've written all my life in relationship to my work. And my grandfather was a poet of moderate note. And so I was like, it's in my blood, right? But at the end, I do believe in editors. So I had several editors work with me on the book. And I don't think you get a real, even if you're quite a competent writer, you need editors. Editors bring in that outside view and, you know, really help you with that final polish, I guess, right?
And so you did bring in, you had some editors that added, that brought in that final polish?
Yes, yes.
And how important are editors? I mean, that seems like that was crucial then. And I mean, without going into too much of that, what was the final polish? It sounds like a polish isn't really talking about the structure of the poem, which was, as you said already, in your blood, essentially.
Yes, I didn't really. There's different levels of editing, and some people, some editors will really rewrite things. I had more line editors, so they would help me with the structure of the poem, where the darn commas went, things like agreement among verbs. If I was transgressing some sort of, you know, fundamental poetic, there aren't really that many rules in poetry, but there are principles, you know. So they helped me a lot with those kind of things, but it was at the end of the process. So the structure of the poems, they didn't really do anything. One woman helped me with a title that I really appreciated. That was great, and she had me like repeat some lines at the end, and so that did affect some of the structure of the poem. But as I say, it was more line editing.
And let's hear one more, if you can, another excerpt perhaps before we move on.
Okay, let me look at this. I think, so the end of the book is trying to find pathways to healing. Our relationship with the planet, healing ourselves, healing the planet, you know, just sort of all around the whole circle. And I was lucky enough to... let's see, I'm going to pick, let me just look at this for a second here, which one has sort of the best ending to it. So I was having a trip up the coast of California, and I have been reading a fair amount about the indigenous population here in California, which suffered, you know, grievous attacks by the early settlers and by the Mexican slavers and all the epidemics. They really had terrible trials as their land was taken over. And I was lucky enough to meet a man from the Pomo tribe when I was out traveling around. And he started just telling me stories from his family. And I didn't know, for instance, that all of the Pomo tribes were taken up to Fort Bragg at a certain point and kind of held there. After a while, it kind of became more like a village. And then after a number of years and, like, you know, a generation had grown up there, they said, okay, you can go back to your land. And with no support, this was like the Trail of Tears. They call it the Bloody Trail. And he was there talking to me because his grandmother survived that ordeal. And when they came back, because of the Homestead Act, a lot of their land had been taken. So this was, you know, just all part of this, you know, really criminal downward spiral that they had to experience at that point. And so this is called Two Halves of the Story. And this is about a 3-minute poem. Let's see.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, let's read it. That sounds fine. 3 minutes
okay.
is okay.
So Two Halves of the Story, and it's dedicated to this man that I met. Ago, we say, long ago, even long, long ago, we told tales by the fire, our eyes bright, whispering the stories, how the world was born, and how its two sides fit together like halves of a clamshell. Binding curves embrace every desire to love, to birth, to care, to hold, to peel the vegetables and light the fire. Binding curves embrace every desire to take, to tear, to grip the blade, knuckles white, bullwhips hanging in calloused fists. two halves of the story, two halves of our hands, plus one half of the tools and one half of the weapons. Each side filled with stories, coiled strings of cloudy pearls. Here their half, shrouded in dark details, the raging fevers, the lost lands, the bloody trail. He tells me his grandmother walked that cruel path, but she was strong and walked on as others fell. So now he stands by an empty lighthouse, watching, waiting to see the rivers run red with salmon again. The other half of the story is hardly ever told, and all the details molder under stacks of tall tales. A few persistent specters poking in piles of old papers, turning to dirt on floors of locked sheds, still know. Could the world once have been round like a fresh-picked apple, without a single bite taken, and all the stories fit together in one song, and every night they sang together, and the wind blew all their words up to the mountains? Or perhaps the world was never round, the stories were never sung, and the words were always burned to white ash in the fire. Two halves of the story, two halves of our hands, one half of the weapons, one half of the tools.
Thank you. Yeah, that's lovely. And of course, very sad. I want to ask you about the idea of environmental cause, or perhaps we should talk about the notion of a green enlightenment.
Yes. So the Green Enlightenment is my idea based on the original Enlightenment, which rose in the late 1700s in France. And it was a new era of intellectual freedom. And their meme, or little verbal hallmark, was dare to think. And they believed that all men and women and children could advance their lives through education. And as a teacher, you know, that's an idea very close to my heart. And that government should work for the people, not for the monarchs and not for the aristocrats. And these ideas really propelled our own revolution. And so I think that we have to re-embrace some of these Enlightenment values. And, they were very involved in the development of science and logic and knowledge. But beyond dare to think, we also need to dare to care today. So the larger natural environment is suffering, and I think most people understand that. And it's so hard to engage with this idea. We don't want to feel responsible for this. But, one time I was at a party, and when I first started learning this stuff, I would go to these parties, and I would go like, do you understand hormone disruption? Do you understand what's happening with the extinction crisis? You know? And one woman said to me, Deborah, how can you think of this stuff all the time? And, admittedly, she had a point. I was supposedly at a party. And later on, though, my pithy comeback that I would have said was, we're the only adults this planet has. And if we're not willing to look at what's going on, if we're not willing to care about what's going on, then we're really, really in dire straits. So I'm hoping that, we can revive. We can create a new green enlightenment and revive these values and extend them to the natural world.
And what do you think you do? The idea of dare to care is powerful, and the book is really a call to action in some ways. In terms of those listening to this and thinking, yeah, what can I do? Is it everybody in his own kind of small way, or is there something specific that you think we should do to usher in this green enlightenment and have a part in it being successful?
Well, Theodore Roosevelt said, do what you can with what you have where you are. And that certainly applies to this situation. Some of the ideas that I have about this that I try and put in practice, one is crowdsourcing. So we have people today who are putting a lot of money into not very progressive organizations. What if all of us started sending $3 to environmental groups? My book has a list of environmental groups in the back, and to progressive political groups. What if every one of us who is progressive started to vote and got one other person to vote? If all you can do is buy one organic T-shirt, do that once a year, and suddenly they won't cost a fortune. So I think that we have to do the things that we know of, but the scope and scale of the changes we have to make to have a thriving world and to have a positive future for ourselves and our children are not going to be tinkering around the edges. We do need to have new laws. We do need to support the Paris Accord. But we need profound changes to actually have a healthy world and healthy children and healthy lives. So I really am calling for the first enlightenment was really a movement that swept a country and then went out to all the other European countries and then came to America. And people really embraced those ideas and put their lives on the line for them and created the first modern democracy. What an extraordinary idea that a government should not work just for the powerful, but should support and work for the health and well-being of ordinary people. This is an extraordinary idea, and it's very threatened today. It's threatened here in America and around the planet as authoritarian impulses are arising. So I think that we really need a global and national movement, and we do see extraordinary numbers of organizations working to this end. Al Gore is certainly pulling his weight. You know, go see An Inconvenient, his new book, his new movie, An Inconvenient Solution. I'm going tomorrow night. And so, you know, we all need to embrace also, there's the Jewish tradition of Tikkun Olam, which means that we have to repair the world. So we have a shared responsibility to pursue social justice and to repair and heal and transform the world.
I like that. It's really lovely. And before we go, I want to ask you what you're reading now. The question I ask everybody at the end could be off topic or not.
Yeah, you know, a new book that, you know, my book is sort of a graphic poetry book. And I recently had an art show at my school. I teach in community college. And the students really responded to it because this kind of graphic, this mix of image and text is catching on in a new way and growing beyond what we would think of as comic books, right? So I sort of see my book as kind of part of this new movement of combining image and text. And one that I've been looking at recently that's very interesting is called Thunder and Lightning by Lauren Redness. And it's a lovely book where she tells all kinds of wonderful, quirky stories about weather. And she also discusses climate change. And she has a lovely, kind of whimsical way of drawing. And so it's really one of these new books that are graphic. Hers is really a graphic science book, and she's done other ones as well. And it's, again, this sort of interesting mix of image and text.
Deborah, it's really been a pleasure talking with you. I want to congratulate you on your book, and thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, I so appreciate the time. And if I can just finish with a little plug, Nature Speaks, Art and Poetry for the Earth. It is available on Amazon. But if you buy from my press, White Cloud Press, it's, of course, a great gift to some wonderful people who are really trying to promote some wonderful ideas.
Very good. And let me just say that, yeah, there'll be links to both of that on the interview so people can get that. And White Cloud Press, is there other books from White Cloud Press as well?
Yes. You know, Stephen Scholl has been sort of at the helm. He started this press up in Ashland quite a long time ago. He's an Islamic scholar. And so he has some poetry books. He's kind of building up his environmental section. And he also has a number of books on spiritual topics. They have a big website.
Again, that's exciting. Okay, so there'll be links to that here. And Deborah, again, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, Brainerd, it's just been such a delight. I so appreciate everything you're doing, the way you're supporting artists and helping this flow of information go out there for people to help people live their dreams.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.